Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles, and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending the 16th of September 1923, the Germans get creative when it comes to money, the Spanish don't get creative when it comes to changing the government, Mussolini is the saviour of the Western world, 7 US destroyers are destroyed, and Ulster's problems are about to be solved for good. But first, the headlines. In an effort to tackle the hyperinflation gripping the country, the German government, the cause of all the trouble, has announced that it is introducing a new currency which will be based on rye. More on that later. There has been a coup in Spain. The Marquis de Estella, as the Times knows him, or Primo de Rivera, as history knows him, has been asked to form an administration. Italy has agreed to evacuate Corfu, having extracted humiliating concessions from Greece. 7 US destroyers have been wrecked after hitting rocks off the coast of Santa Barbara in California. At a steelworks in Middlesbrough, a vat of molten steel fell from a crane, killing 5 men. This is from Thursday the 13th. During a football match in Palmer Park, Reading yesterday, a man was exhibiting a small bomb, which exploded while being handled. 2 spectators were badly injured and 3 others hurt. I'm going to guess, although we will probably never know for sure, that this is a Great War grenade rather than something this man knocked up in his shed. Your occasional reminder that unexploded ordnance is dangerous. I was amused to read this commentary on the Soviets in an article on Anglo-Soviet trade. This is from Saturday the 15th. As propagandists, they are undeniably the finest experts in the world. Any similarity between the Soviet Union of then and the Russia of today is entirely cultural. There was an advertisement in Saturday's edition. Tomorrow's Sunday pictorial will contain a remarkable article, Mussolini, What Europe Owes to Him, by Lord Rothermere. In case you don't know, Lord Rothermere is the owner of both the Daily Mail and the Daily Mirror. His brother was the late Lord Northcliffe, who until his death was the owner of the Times. Lord Rothermere says that the great work already accomplished by Signor Mussolini is much misunderstood in Great Britain. Had it not been for Mussolini's intervention, Italy might have been completely Bolshevist today. He knew his own mind, knew what to do, and did it. Rothermere may well be right about the danger posed by communism in Italy. See the 15th of October 1922 episode. It goes on. He did much more than save Italy, for he really saved the whole Western world. He has proved himself to be a very great man and is certainly not a blustering, flag-waving agitator. Well, I suppose he could be both. He goes on. Italy, with a population almost as large as that of France, is one of the greatest of world powers today. It is madness for us to quarrel with her, or to suffer our Foreign Office or our representatives on the League of Nations to assail the Italians or their great leader upon an issue in which Italy is entirely right. A sentiment which has a curiously familiar ring to it. As mentioned earlier, the German government is introducing a new currency which will be based on rye. This presents a number of practical problems, but to explain why, we need some background. There was a time when the government minted gold coins which then passed into general circulation. Some people were better at business than others and ended up with large collections of these coins. This was an inconvenience as they were heavy and were a tempting target for thieves. So, they would take them to the bank and store them there. In return, the bank would issue them with a receipt. These receipts were a lot lighter and easier to store. Even better, because they were elaborately marked, they were difficult to forge. And because they were difficult to forge, others were happy to accept them instead of gold. They were literally as good as gold. A little bit later, government thought this was a nice little earner and decided to get in on the act. The central bank was born. Now, the German government of 1923 doesn't have gold, so it has decided to base its currency on rye. But unless I'm very much mistaken, the German government doesn't have any Rye either, unless it tends to steal, sorry, tax it. Okay, clearly, that is what they intend to do, but, correct me if I'm wrong, Rye is rather bulky. Where does the government intend to store it? And does it really intend Germans to be able to present these Rye-based marks and receive Rye in return? The Times has this to say. This is from Saturday the 15th. Mortgages bearing interest at the rate of 5% per annum will be raised on a certain proportion of the productive value of every landed estate in Germany. The bank, which would now possess a lien on a certain proportion of the German products, would issue bonds in terms of Rye values. These bonds would take the place of a gold reserve. Now, I know what a mortgage is, I know what a lien is, I know what a bond is, but put it all together and I haven't a clue. But, spoiler alert, the Rye or Rentenmark will succeed in putting an end to the hyperinflation. Ireland is now independent. But where should the border be? A special correspondent attempts to explain the ins and outs of the issue. This is from Tuesday the 11th. Before the Free State elections were held, Mr. Cosgrave, the Irish president, appointed a boundary commissioner and requested the British government to fulfil its obligations under Article 12 of the Anglo-Irish Treaty. This article, after recognising the right of the government of Northern Ireland to contract out of the Free State, provides that if the Belfast Parliament avails itself of this right, a commission consisting of three persons, one to be appointed by the government of the Irish Free State, one to be appointed by the government of Northern Ireland, and one who shall be chairman, to be appointed by the British government, shall determine in accordance with the wishes of the inhabitants, so far as may be compatible with economic and geographic conditions, the boundaries between Northern Ireland and the rest of Ireland. The problem here is that the Ulster British and Ulster Irish are thoroughly intermingled. Some people are going to end up on the wrong side of the border, like my ancestors, for instance. Although it worked out reasonably well for them, the intermingling itself is to a large extent to do with economics. For instance, the Industrial Revolution brought huge numbers of Irishmen into previously exclusively British Belfast. If the idea that mass migration brought about by economics can bring political problems has a familiar ring to it, all I can say is banish that thought from your mind, you bigot. It goes on. The Northern government will refuse to appoint a commissioner. The reason is that they were not a party to the treaty. Not being party to discussions that affect them has been a consistent complaint of Ulster Unionists down the years. It goes on. I may add that were the British government to propose and the British Parliament to pass an amending act to the Anglo-Irish Treaty, empowering the delimitation of the boundary without the consent of the Northern Parliament, a situation resembling that of 1912 to 1914 might easily arise. While elements in the Free State Army and still more probably Republicans might be tempted to create incidents which might have disastrous political results. A reminder that in 1912 Unionists set up their own army to resist being governed from Dublin. It may be asked why the Ulster government is so anxious to retain its political rights over areas such as parts of Tyrone and Fermanagh, not to mention South Armagh, which are inhabited by a majority of anti-partitionist Roman Catholics. It's one of the great irritations of the Ulster issue that outsiders constantly refer to Ulster's divisions in religious terms. It has nothing to do with religion. But why should the Northern government be so keen? South Armagh is staunchly Irish. The late David Trimble, former Ulster Unionist leader, described the prospect of South Armagh joining the Republic as good riddance. Tyrone and Fermanagh are a different matter. Typically, they voted for Irish nationalists, but, huge spoiler alert, in 1924 it was believed that their vote would determine which side of the border they ended up on. For the first and only time, they elected a unionist. Why? I don't know, but it is a consistent feature of the Ulster Irish that while they will happily vote for Irish nationalist candidates, when they are confronted with the prospect of actually being governed from Dublin, they tend to shy away. It goes on. Apart from the fear that the Protestant minorities, more religion, in such areas would suffer in consequence to their transfer to the Free State, and the certain loss of revenue, moderate Ulster Protestants believe that given the present temper of the extreme element, naturally embittered by the carrying of the war into the six counties by the Republicans, and still ready to meet attack with sanguinary reprisals, the law-abiding Roman Catholics residing in Belfast and other parts of partitionist Ulster, which would not be affected by the delimitation, would run considerable risk from Orange mobs. This risk would be all the greater if any agitation on the boundary were accompanied by political crimes, as might well be the case. Inquiries in Ulster have convinced me that an increasing number of Northern Roman Catholics dislike the raising of the boundary question for the same reason, and also because they know that even if the boundary were to be drawn in accordance with the Southern claims, two-thirds of them would still remain under the rule of the Protestant majority, freshly irritated. Ex hypothesi, that means according to the hypothesis, at a moment when it was beginning to resume neighbourly relations with the minority. Resume? Hardly. On and near the border, there are of course many Roman Catholics who would prefer to be included in the Free State, in spite of higher taxation and lower administrative efficiency. Interesting that the correspondent can feel confident saying that, when the Irish Free State is about a year and a half old, and for most of that time has been fighting a civil war. He is entirely correct, of course. It goes on. In spite of all that has happened, the Northern Roman Catholic has a distinct respect for his Protestant neighbour, often enough his racial kinsman, whom he considers more trustworthy and more constructive than his Southern co-religionist, though he may not openly admit it. And during the last few months, quite a number of ex-gunmen have come back to Ulster, made their peace with the constabulary, and handed over their arms, having on occasion deposited them by arrangement in Protestant churchyards for the constables to collect later in the evening. Well, that's, how shall I put it, a somewhat rosy view of things. Anyway, that's all for this week. At this point, I usually say I aim to have something up next week, but due to prior commitments, that's looking unlikely. But I do aim to have something up the week after that.